mind hitting that button there? Thanks. Hello, everyone on the phone. We are back, and we are going to go ahead and ask Dr. Rendon to talk about 2020 eradication efforts by ODA. And you should have received the PowerPoint from Ted sometime around the beginning of this meeting. And sorry that we didn't have the webinar set up for you, but we'll try and let them know as you advance through the slides. If you want to go ahead and open your PowerPoint up, you'll see a very beautiful picture, I must say, of a Japanese beetle. They're very, lovely insects.
Yeah, they are very pretty. Pretty and destructive.
Yes. Would you like to go ahead and kick us off then?
Yeah, so I'm going to give you guys an update about our eradication activities last year, mostly talking about the Japanese beetle. That's the big one that we've been fighting since 2017. I'll talk about gypsy moth as well. We did have an eradication activity last summer in Corvallis. Mm-hmm. And then if there's time, I'll just briefly mention European Schaefer and light brown apple moth.
I think there'll be time for you.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll make the time.
So I'm going to the next slide. So just background information on the Japanese beetle. As the name suggests, it is native to Japan. It was first found in the U.S. in New Jersey in 1916. In nursery stock. Since then, it has spread throughout a lot of the eastern part of the U.S. and some of the Midwestern states as well. It's a highly destructive insect. It feeds over on 300 different plant species. Pretty much everything we like, our grass, our ornamental plants, our edible plants, flowers, they will devour all of that. And it's considered the single most important turf grass pest in the U.S. It's something we really do not want to have in Oregon. Going to the next slide. Here are just some pictures of the damage that the beetle can do. In its larval form, it's in the soil and it eats the roots of grass and other ornamental plants. Those first two pictures, you can see a dead patch of grass where the larva in the soil has been eating all those roots and causing dieback. When they emerge out of the soil as adults, they feed on the foliage of plants and the flowers. They do what's called skeletonizing the leaf, so they eat all the nice, juicy parts of the leaf and they leave the tougher veins behind, so it's like a skeleton of the plant that's left. That bottom picture is a rose flower head that's completely or almost completely eaten. Portland is known for its roses. We have our rose garden. If the beetle were to become established in the state, they would have to completely change how they operate. They have a test garden at that rose garden where they basically just let the new flower hybrids and varieties naturally see what's going to survive without doing any treatment. If the beetle were to be here, they could not do that kind of experimentation, which would be sad. At the top is a linden or a maple tree. It's a little hard to see from the picture, but it's becoming completely defoliated in the summer, and it should have its leaves needed for photosynthesis and growing properly.
In that trench back there on the bottom left.
Mm. Yeah, that one is, so they pulled back the turf to see what was under there, and that was all the Japanese beetle grubs under there. That's a really high infestation leader. Here in Oregon, last year, we were looking for the grubs in the soil, and we went to the high density area here in Oregon where we have the beetle, but we couldn't find any larvae, so they're comparatively in small numbers here, but we don't want someday to lift up the turf. And going to the next slide. So the beetle is established back east. One of the ways it can get into Oregon is moving nursery stock through cargo airplanes, long-haul trucks, shipping containers. Those are all pathways the beetle can get to Oregon. And the current infestation we're fighting, we believe it got here from someone that probably lived back east, and they had beloved outdoor plants that maybe they're in the family, and we put a lot of time and money into our plants. We love them, so we bring them with us, but in this case, they probably brought beetle larvae in the soil. Those beetles emerged, and they're trying to invade all of Oregon. So as Ted mentioned, moving plants around, especially across state boundaries, can often lead to moving really destructive pests, not just insects, but pathogens and viruses.
I guess to Ted's point before, it could be just the plant itself.
Yeah. It could be an invasive plant. Because the threat of the Japanese beetle is so huge for our state, because we don't have an established population yet, Oregon has been trapping for it since the 70s or 80s, for the last several decades at least. We've been trapping throughout the state for the beetle. These traps, it's a little green funnel trap that has a floral lure and a sex pheromone. So it smells like roses, kind of like an artificial dead bouquet of roses, I think. But the beetles love it. And then it also smells like female beetles, so the males are highly attracted to it. They'll smell this, they'll hit the little wings that are up top, and they'll fall down into the cup at the bottom, and they're not able to crawl or fly back out. So keep your eyes open for these traps. They're going to be placing them toward April through May and June is when most of the traps should be set. So keep your eyes out. You might see them. Even here in the city, they trap.
How many thousands of these traps does ODA put out a year?
It's 10 or 30,000.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a huge number.
Oh, yeah.
We have Oregon's broken up into five main field office locations, and each of those locations puts out the traps in that territory. Yeah. Mostly here in the greater Portland area is where the most risk is, because all the airports and commerce that's going on. But they're throughout the state, and more so in airports and cargo areas.
And I assume it's not random.
No.
The placement.
No. So we pick locations that we think have the highest probability of having beetles moved to, and they make these grids. Yeah. And you can't follow it exactly, but mostly it's in a grid pattern. And next slide. Okay, so getting into the current infestation we're battling. In 2016, we found 369 beetles in the Cedar Mill Bethany area. This was more beetles than had ever been caught in the state combined. And so this immediately enacted a response plan to try and eradicate this beetle from the state. So 2017 was our first year of treatment, where we applied a targeted insecticide to the turf and ornamental plants. And I'll talk more about the products in a few slides from now. But this first year, it was roughly 1,000 acres and 2,500 properties we treated. And the thing about the treatment is it's a one-year delay. So we put down the insecticide in 2017. We won't know if it's effective until the end of 2018. It targets the next generation. So in that summer, or by the end of the summer when all of our traps were in, we found over 23,000 beetles. All those little red dots are beetle catches. And that's a huge, huge amount of beetles. At this point in time, we were not very optimistic that we could eradicate it. We are more optimistic now, but it's still, we'll see. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
Before you go to the next slide, I remember, you know, the cluster down by Orchard Park, that's where the landscape haulers went, and there's some a little bit south. I don't remember the sort of the Swan Islands bits.
Yeah, so Swan Island, most years we do catch beetles at Swan Island and at the airport every year. Those are separate introductions that are coming in on, well, the airport, that are coming in on cargo planes. And then Swan Island It's either UPS or FedEx
has
a hub, and so they're coming in on the packages. So those are a separate, not an established population yet, but we usually treat, we treat at the airport every year, and sometimes we do at Swan Island. So, jumping ahead to the next year, because we found so many more beetles spread outside our original treatment area, we increased our treatment area from 1,000 acres to roughly 2,000. And this, I think we treated 5,800 properties. And you can see there's some satellite areas. As Ted mentioned, the one to the left is where we have our yard debris drop-off site. So one way the beetle could potentially spread is if people just through yard debris. Usually yard debris goes to composting facilities throughout that area, but if beetles are being spread to many different places, it will be too difficult to control. So having one location where they go, if beetles are being transported there, we can have a, hopefully have a handle on that one spot instead of, you know, several others. So it kind of, Chris used to call it a proof of concept, that beetles are in yard debris, and they need to go to only one place if they're being moved out of that main blob.
So you're treating, excuse me, just the yard debris?
Oh, no. So we're treating the turf and the ornamental plants with the insecticide, and then any yard debris, like lawn clippings or people cutting, you know, flowers.
At the Orchard Park facility, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, yes, we're treating there as well, the turf and ornamental plants, yeah. And we're trapping more heavily there as well, because we know there's beetles there, so we have more traps on the ground to really get a clear picture of where they are. So it's, yeah, it's a big project. Mm-hmm. So this next slide will show if or how effective our 2017 treatment was. And we did have some reduction. So the year prior, it was about 23,000 beetles. In 2018, it was 17,000 beetles. That is about a 30% reduction, which is in the right direction, but we were hoping for a much larger reduction. So in 2019, again, we increased the size because the beetles were still spreading. So we wanted to try to get a handle on that spread. So before I go into our results from last year, I want to talk about the products we use and our outreach to the public. So the two main products we use is Acelaprin G and Grubgon. Acelaprin G, the main the active ingredient is chlorantraniliprole. This is the main product we use for the vast majority of properties. Last year, we did an additional supplementary treatment of a foliar spray for the first time, where beetles were in the highest density. We were trying to do like a 1-2 punch. The granular attacks or kills the grubs in the soil. The liquid is sprayed onto the foliage that'll kill adults if they eat it. And then Grubgon, we've been offering this for people that are opting out for a medical exemption. This product, it's a naturally occurring bacteria in the soil. This one I don't think has gotten their organic status, but BT products are often used in organic farming. We don't know if we'll use, we're still offering medical exemptions this year, but we don't know if we're gonna use the Grubgon product. A study that came out last year showed that it's kind of finicky. It can only be effective under the right soil conditions. Only one out of their field trials showed somewhat of a reduction in grubs in the soil. So it might not be worth using, but
save some resources.
Yeah, exactly. And with Acelaprin, we've tried to do as much public outreach as we can to inform the public that it's a reduced risk insecticide. There's no caution words on the label, no restricted entry period. Unlikely to have any adverse effects on people, kids, pets, and other non-target organisms. This has been one of the huge challenges, as Ted mentioned, especially this year, because our area is so large, we're encountering more and more people It's just increasing our chances of having some difficult conversations. So next slide. So we have many outreach. So before we can treat the people's properties, we have to get their consent to do so. And we do this by several different ways. We have online consent forms if we have their email address from the year prior. We do several physical mailers in the mail. We send out reminder postcards. If we don't hear back from the resident at that point, we do physical door hangers. So hopefully they will see it that way. And then we do a second door notice the week before treatment, just trying to get their response one way or the other. And of course, this is a picture from a prior open house a couple years ago. But this year we had successful. We had lots of people come to the open houses, a lot of good conversations, sharing information. We had Ted there, our pesticides department, Tualatin Soil Water District, and Oregon Health Authority, I think, was there for both or one of the events.
Yeah, one this year.
DEQ was there?
Yes, DEQ. Yes.
Because they permit the facility where the green waste is set.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Crystal told me the one that she attended was pretty well attended by the public. And I was wondering, since you had expanded the area again, I know last year the open house seemed like it was pretty scantily attended for whatever reason. It's good to hear that there was more uptake this time.
Yeah, last year I think we had like 4 people show up. This year we had 30 or so at the first one and maybe over 80 at the second one.
On Saturday.
Yeah, so this year we really pushed more outreaching, trying to get the word out through social media and blog posts and Nextdoor and Facebook. We really pushed hard to get that word out, and it worked.
At the open houses I've been to, I've noticed that 90% of the people show up in the first hour, which means usually the last hour and a half we're just having a conversation amongst ourselves, which is fine. There's a reason we're there.
Yeah, so last year when all was said and done, we had roughly 98% of people that did respond to us say yes to treatment. 110 said no, 40 said wanted a medical exemption, and then we had about a little over 500 people that didn't respond either way after our several attempts to try to reach them. And for those people, we go to the Justice Department to get a administrative warrant to treat their properties. We've reached out to them several times, have not heard back, so then we go that route to treat the properties.
And how successful is that?
Very, yeah.
Good, all right.
Yeah, so I'll just jump in. So the warrant part, last year we served 470 out of those 530. We didn't do all of them because there was either nothing to treat on the property or there was nothing there. Yeah, I guess those are the only real reasons we wouldn't treat if there's nothing needed to treat. The vast majority of people know that it's coming, like they realize they didn't turn it in and they just know we're gonna come back and they're fine with it. Other people, they'll go grab the consent form that they just didn't send in, they didn't have time to send it back to us, and they're very apologetic. Only one person out of that 470 was not happy. And so in that case, we did not treat their property because they were very aggressive and just wanted us to leave immediately. And in that situation, at this point in time, that one property is not essential for the program, and it's not worth our safety at this point in time.
And so some of those properties were just unoccupied properties. I imagine the one on the right. So people on the phone were on a slide that's titled Japanese Beetle Treatment Granular Soil Application 2019. And someone says reaching up to knock on a door, it can't be an occupied house.
There's no steps.
Yeah. No steps, yeah.
Yeah. There's all kinds of weird things we encounter.
Maybe it's one of those Portland Water Bureau like water pump houses.
But isn't there a light on?
Yeah, the porch lights, huh?
I need to ask what the final say was, if someone did come to the door or not. I forget the story.
A really tall person.
Let's see. Yeah, so it was very successful treatment. We treated over 8,500 properties, schools, parks, shopping centers, a big golf course, and yeah, we didn't have any major incidences. Going to the next slide, as I mentioned, we did a foliar spray last year. It was completely voluntary, and we only did one outreach for, or one request for consent to do this foliar spray. And from that one outreach event, we had almost 50% of the people respond to us and consent to it, which I think is a really high number. It often takes many more attempts to hear back from people. And that also went well. And then again, we treated roughly 22 of the properties with the Grub Gone insecticide.
And that one on the right, I think that's a birch tree getting sprayed into.
I think so.
Nice to see in our part of town, all the birch trees are getting eaten up by birch boring bark beetles.
The bronze birch borer.
Yeah, there's
a lot of bad insects.
Yeah.
And going to the next, slide, this is the big finale for Japanese beetle. Again, this was our treatment area last year. We caught a little over, almost 8,000 beetles last year, which is a huge reduction. It's roughly a 56% reduction, which is really exciting for us. We're optimistic that we can eradicate it. It will remain to be seen, but this is a really good number. But you can notice there are definitely beetles outside of the treatment area.
Yeah.
And that's the down part of the message. That's concerning. So because of all those little catches outside, going to the next slide, this is our 2020 treatment area, which is about 4,000 acres in size. It's getting to be a very large project. And we have several smaller satellite areas. In the past, we might not have treated some of these smaller areas because there's fewer beetles in our friend in Chuck's neighborhood. It's the top right one, the closest one to the blob on the right. In that area, right by his house, I think it was only about three or so beetles. In that whole area, it was 10 to 15, which is not a huge number, but because we had such reduction, we are being more aggressive this year, and we don't want to rely on those smaller numbers just blipping out on their own. We want to be certain that they do not spread and become a bigger issue that will be harder to contain. And this one just shows, it's a little hard to see, but inside the main purple area, there's smaller pink areas. That's where we're planning on doing the foliar spray. That's where we have the largest number of beetles caught. And so hopefully those two things together will increase our chances of getting rid of the beetle. This is just an overview slide of all the numbers, so you can see it all at once. The main things between 2017 and 18, it was about a 26% reduction in overall numbers. And one reason also I forgot to mention for that is that first year we only treated turf grass, not ornamental plants. In 2018 and 19, we treated both. So that might be, and we did the foliar spray, so that might be one reason why we had increased reduction. And again, this year, we're going to be tracking and eradicating at the Cedar Mill area and at Portland Airport, because we always get beetles there. Last year we had 32 beetles, which is a larger amount than usual. So we make sure that's not a new establishing population. We might go past Swan Island in Oakland because I want to get to Gypsy Moth. But
you're good for time.
You think?
Yeah, you're fine. Time.
All right, well. Yeah, just briefly, Swan Island, sort of like PDX, we always catch a few beetles there. Because they're in such low numbers at the moment, we're not treating. So they seem to be just beetles that are singletons or doubles that get brought in, but they're not actively mating and producing new offspring at Swan Island. But we're going to continue to monitor that, and if that changes, we will definitely treat there. And then Oakland, in 2017, we found 10 beetles there, which was the last thing we wanted to deal with when we had Cedar Mill to worry about. But we did a small eradication there in 2018. And last year, we only caught one beetle. So because it's only one, we're not doing any treatments, but we're continuing to monitor with high traps there to really see what's going on and to make sure there's not more beetles. And if there is, then we'll do another eradication.
So what's the, what's the dispersal thing? So you're picking up for detections outside your treatment areas. Is it because they're traveling further than you think, or are they traveling on landscaper vehicles?
Yeah.
Or what do you suppose?
So with Oakland, again, our best guess is that someone moved there and brought plants with them. I think in the 80s, there was, either in Cave Junction or Tiger, there was a Japanese beetle outbreak much smaller than this, but they did trace it back to an individual that had brought their plants with them. For these two, we don't really actively try to investigate who brought it in, unless just by happenstance we can talk to the right person and they tell us that they brought it or brought plants in. But that's our best guess.
I was thinking more from a convenience standpoint.
Mm.
Is it a certain landscape company, and if they're in turf, is there any correlation between like the mowers they're using and then jumping around the neighborhood or that sort of thing?
Or how far can they fly?
They can fly a fair distance. From the papers I've read, if there's good host material, they're not really moving. Some of those satellite areas, we think maybe they get in people's cars just because if they're flying around and they're brought that way. Some of the satellite areas are near a lot of businesses, so maybe people are commuting to work. Or another thing might be people sharing plants. We've been trying to work heavily with the master gardeners in the area. Most of them are aware of the situation and to not do plant sales or move plants from that area outside, but possibly if people are, that could be an explanation of why they're being outside in the area.
I actually got in a conversation with a man who had been doing plant sales in the Cedar Mills area for 20 years. And there's some type of citizen organization. They share plants. But he also showed me a spreadsheet where he's keeping track of individuals who are either in or outside of the treatment area and contacting these individuals and saying either yes or no. You're not allowed to participate this year, or yes, you are, which has raised some interesting conversations because there's people that were in the treatment area last year, and the northern boundary kind of shrunk.
Yeah.
They're not in it this year, but they assumed that they were, and they didn't find out until this person called. They started comparing notes, things along those lines. Very interesting conversations have come about as a result of Japanese beetles.
There's so many different facets of this project.
Are the rules for nurseries really strict? Because I would imagine there's a lot of plant movement across the country, business ventures.
Yeah, so plants are brought in. There is a Home Depot in that main area. At this point in time, we've been talking to our nursery department, and we do have a quarantine in place that says you're not supposed to move plants out of the area. Enforcing that has been the new challenge. Maybe that's another reason if people are buying from that Home Depot and there's beetles there and they go just outside, maybe that's why we're catching them. We're still trying to figure out how to get the best handle. enough about Japanese beetle. This one's a lot quicker. Gypsy moth is another invasive insect that we're always monitoring for in Oregon. It's established back east. It defoliates the foliage of many of the different trees. That picture up there, that road is dividing the nice green side and then the darker, the side that's been all defoliated. It should be as green as the other side, but the moths have completely eaten all the foliage. So again, we do not want this in Oregon. The gypsy moth has irritating hairs that often cause irritation to people. If you're walking in the forest when there's a high infestation, the hairs just naturally fall off the larva and they can irritate people and you get all itchy. It sometimes sounds like it's raining in the forest, but it's actually the larva's frass, the poop, it's raining down and there's so many in there that it sounds like rain. It's not good. Not good at all. Going to the next slide, the gypsy moth trap slide. You can also look for these in trees. We place several thousand every year. The picture on the right is a trapper that found the gypsy moth in Corvallis. And the little green thread in the trap is the sex pheromone. It smells like female moths. So the males are highly attracted to it and they get stuck on the little glue inside. Just briefly, in 2018, the four maps in green show the gypsy moths that we found. These four areas were singletons and doubles. Well, one had three. Because they were so small in number, we just monitor that situation. But the one I want to talk about is in Benton County, where we found 27 moths. That is indicative of an establishing population that if we don't do anything about, it's going to just continue to grow. So 2018, there's 27 moths. This is just showing exactly where they were. They were found around two apartment complexes in Corvallis near OSU. Again, a lot of students, so a lot of students moving into and out of that area, maybe traveling back home and bringing, an RV with them and then coming back, and that RV might have had egg masses on them. Those eggs hatched here and the adults came out and are gonna keep repopulating if we don't stop them. So because of that, in 2018, we did an eradication on those two apartment complexes and about 10 houses right next to
the West Hills.
It is.
With them.
That's what I mean.
With the Moats.
With the hills, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. I had trouble with it.
I'm wondering, Barry, when I first moved to Oregon in the Ashland area, there was some gypsy moth that was highly objectionable.
Yeah, a lot of people.
And what aerial spray?
Yeah, the aerial spray, it requires a lot of outreach and a lot of people aren't a fan of the aerial spray. For this infestation, we didn't go with the aerial spray more from a logistics standpoint, I guess, because it was such a small area, only 46 acres. It would have been difficult to only treat that area and not do a whole lot of treatment outside of it. So we decided to do a ground application with 4-A-XG. This one is a certified organic insecticide that attacks Lepidopteran larvae. So instead of doing the aerial spray, we did a ground spray where we had a contractor with a backpack sprayer manually spray the foliage of the trees. We weren't able to get the very tops of the trees this way, and we were worried that it wouldn't be very effective at reducing the gypsy moth population, but luckily it was. What else about this?
Not backpack.
Huh?
Wasn't backpack.
No. Yeah, for the most part, we didn't have too many negative public interactions. Only a few people were concerned, and our crew members talked to them about their concerns, and it took place over two weeks. Treatment in May and June, believe, last year.
So I was out there on day one to observe and talking about bullet point number one, keeping folks out of the area. Mm-hmm. When we told them it was a pesticide, they didn't care, and they kept right on walking. It was at times difficult to keep people out of the area. We would tell them, what are you spraying? Organic, BTK. They kept right on walking.
Yeah, see, that's, you know.
Kept right on walking. Going back to Asian gypsy moth in Portland a couple of years ago when we sprayed, there was a nursery in the treatment area that advertised organic, you know, ornamentals, I believe it was, that were BTK treated. As kind of, he thought it was a good thing that his plants are now protected. Free of charge because ODA did it.
There you go.
So, and with this treatment, there is no, you don't have to wait a full year to see if it's effective. So that's a good thing. I'm impatient. I want to know right away. So last year, we only found 3 moths in that same area. Because there's only 3, this year we're not going to do any spraying, but we're still going to trap heavily. Hopefully, we can trap out what is ever left, but if we find another 27, then we'll do another eradication. But hopefully, the trapping will take care of what's left. This just summarizes the findings. Those 4 counties where we found a couple moths. Last year we found no moths in those areas, so we're just going to trap in 2020. In Benton County, we found 3 moths, and so we're just going to continue to trap. A new find last year was in Tillamook County at a campground in Pacific City. We found 1 moth, so again, we'll continue to trap there, and hopefully it was just one random one that got transported in an egg mass, but we'll monitor it.
Are there any studies that show the effectiveness of just trapping and how many individual population you're pulling out?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the species, but I haven't looked into that in detail, but I would say it definitely depends on the species, how effective it can be.
These were Asian gypsy moth?
These ones just European.
European.
Just European, sorry. European gypsy moth. I think we did find Asian gypsy moth egg masses on some of the cargo shipping containers that came in, but no adult moths. Then going really fast, 2 slides about the light brown apple moth. This is another pest of several edible plant trees like apple and pear. It's in California in a couple of counties, and for the first time in 2010 it was found in Oregon. Again, we don't want this pest in our state. First in 2010, first moth in Polk County. 2016 we found 5 more there. Because of that, we did an aerial spray of another BT product. We found only, in 2018, we found no moths in Polk County, but 1 in Douglas County. So we continued to monitor both those sites for any additional moths. And last year we found none, which is a good sign that we eradicated that small population that might have been starting. So again, no eradication activities are planned, but we're going to keep monitoring. Last one, European shaper. It's another scarab beetle that's invasive. It's found in some of the eastern states. It feeds mainly on the grass roots. It's not as destructive as a Japanese beetle, but maybe that's not true. Either way, we don't want another invasive insect in the state. So we're always monitoring for at the airport. In 2015 was the first time it was found at the airport in Oregon. A couple more years passed, so there's getting more and more numbers. In 2019, we found a large amount there, and four at Swan Islands, again, probably being brought in by shipping containers and UPS. Because we found such a large number of the beetles there, we have been treating with the same product that we treat for Japanese beetle. We think our timing might have been off the last year or two, though. Talking with Syngenta, they're now suggesting treating a little earlier for the European chafer than we do the Japanese beetle. When European chafer gets in high numbers, a lot of birds will be eating the grubs that are in the soil, and a lot of birds at an airport, as you know, is bad news. We don't want any aircrafts being hit by all these additional birds that are attracted to the beetles in the soil. So this year we'll be treating there as well for European chafer. And yeah, I can take any more questions you might have. It's a lot of material.
So I don't have any questions, but I'm recalling the efforts in Polk County.
For light brown apple moth?
Correct. And I believe the product was something called Splat.
Yeah.
But the aircraft is one of a kind aircraft. It's the only one in the country that literally could apply this product. And I believe the man was based in Minnesota. Had to get an NPDES permit because it was right alongside a river, and certainly concerned about deposition. It's only BTK, but still. There was a lot that went into that effort just for 510 acres. And there's actually videos out there about the product itself, which is not like any formulation you probably have seen before.
Is this helicopter or fixed wing?
Fixed wing.
Yeah, I just missed that. I think I started in 2018, so I just missed that. Yeah. Keep us busy.
Yeah.
You can imagine when ODA staff are beginning to put out traps, they probably start in a van, and all four people are probably sitting in the front two seats because all of the back is filled up with traps. And the more traps they put out, then the staff have more room in the vehicle.
They have their little light on the top of the van, so you pull over real fast and put out the traps.
That's quite the effort.
Well, thanks for giving us this presentation. It's really fascinating.
So go back to Japanese beetles. When are we going to start?
March 30th, I think, will be our very first day of treatment. And we're going to start with the apartment complexes because it's a really nice introductory to the new crew leads, and it's an easy way to jump into the season.
And because of the expanded treatment area, how long is it going to take?
We anticipate till the very beginning of June. We don't want to...
Wow.
Yeah. So that's like two and a half months-ish.
Hopefully we'll beat them hatching.
Imagine your contractors had to expand their staffing.
Yes. Yeah, both ODA and General Tree Service, I think we had to hire at least... We were hoping to hire two more people. One person took a different position, but I think we'll still be able to have more crew on the ground.
All right. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, and with that, we'll move into the last item of our agenda, the park report. Are you going to need anything on the computer for this?
We're going to try and see how this goes.
All right.
I think I have the report, the park report pulled up on the computer. And I know that, here we go. Oh, wow, that actually works perfect. Are you using the pointer to do that, or are you using the...
No, the mouse. I don't think this is going to help you out. Oh, no, it does. There you go. Just the same, page down to the right.
Okay.
And let me know if you want me to make it bigger or smaller. I can hop over there and do that one. There you go. So, folks on the phone, we've got the 1315 Park Report up. You might have that in your inbox. Otherwise, it'll be on the park website.
Correct. I did not send this to you guys. This was kind of a last-minute addition to the agenda. And I know that I've already sent out the data, but I just thought that I would spend a few minutes kind of putting it in the context. So for the next ledge report, the 1517 report, if you look on the far right-hand side of the page, you see the number of incidents. 1517, the number of incidents is 175. 50% of them were human, 12.6% were animal. Not significant, but definitely an increase in the number of environmental, up to 28.6. Park is doing a lot of tracking of pesticide spills, which that is probably indicative of. And the mixed, which is a combination of human-animal or human-environmental or animal-environmental, was down slightly to 8.6%. We're not going to go over data sources. This is the trend for park incidents by month, which kind of mirrors information collected from the National Pesticide Information Center by month over a six-year period of time. I generated and provided this data to you all, but not necessarily going to go over it. I don't expect it to change too much. Oregon counties with the largest populations are still going to have the largest or highest incident rate. Can you move it to the right in the scroll bar?
No, I
can't. Oh, I'm sorry. Can you make it a little smaller?
Yeah.
One more. Perfect. So the top left is application sites and then exposure sites. From a trend perspective, the numbers are still kind of, they kind of match in terms of ag being the number one application site. And of course, it's also the number one exposure site. Then we're going down to single family homes is number one. It's like, where is it? And that's no real surprise. We obviously have a lot of nexus between ag and single family homes. In terms of the targets, you can't see it. That's going to be, maybe I can back up. So in terms of the number of targets, that also hasn't changed. Ag is still the number one. These are application sites. And veg weed control is at the bottom of that chart.
That's interesting because that's not what we find.
From an occupational perspective?
Right. It's not, ag isn't the number one site.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's been
so
where WPS does not apply. I mean, that's what I find. So that's been a kind of a trend, I think, that I've been seeing, that there's this whole group of people that don't have the protections of WPS.
Sure. I'm not going to go over occupational incidents because you can read Garnett's pesticide emphasis report. Just know that there's a slight overlap between parks occupational incidents versus Oregon OSHA's occupational incidents. They report on a federal biennium, so October 1st to September 30th, whereas park does fiscal year June 1st to July 1st to June 30th. So those are pesticide types on the top left. I, believe it or not, didn't generate those until this morning. So herbicides, no surprise, still lead, 130. Insecticides are second with 55, followed by fungicides with 26. Those are the top three. On the top right, there were four products that were identified as restricted use pesticides during this biennium. This time that number doubled to, 15. There's 15 restricted use pesticides. When we look at park incidents, if an RUP was used in more than one park incident, I only listed it once in the report. Animal incidents. During the biennium, park received 32 allegations or reports that animals have been negatively impacted by pesticide use. One involved the misapplication of the active ingredient chlorpyrifos to a creek, resulting in the death of crayfish. Seven incidents involved honeybees. The Department of Ag developed a screen for honeybees where we analyzed for 59 different pesticides. While some samples are positive, it is almost difficult at best to determine a source of the exposure. Bees fly, they can travel up to a couple of miles. I can tell you that in terms of the positive detections, most of them, if not all of them, are in our native bumblebees versus finding positive samples in managed honeybees. There were two geese kills from exposure to presumably zinc phosphide. I've mentioned this before, that in terms of the analysis, it's a presence, absence of phosphine gas. It doesn't necessarily tell you where that phosphine gas came from, whether it's zinc, aluminum, whatever. ODA investigated 27 of the 32 allegations. Reports to impacts to animals, issued 7 notices of violations and 9 letters of advisement. That's it in terms of the data that I wanted to go over. Before we get to Curtis, I am working on a way to reduce the park report from 24 pages. Hopefully I can get it down to 4.
What?
That's my goal.
Super small font.
That's So it was a couple of meetings ago when I reported basically how many people have read the report that's online and has been online for over a year. And my thought is there's a lot of stuff in here that I don't necessarily believe we need to continue to put in the park report. The contributing factors, kind of ambivalent about, but that's 10 pages right there. Do we actually need all of the park member contact information in the report? I need an executive summary. I think we need to keep in terms of notable events and accomplishments. Certainly the board voted to or agreed to take recommendations out, provide them in a more real-time manner. We haven't necessarily decided what that looks like or how it's actually going to get done. Just some thoughts, not decided on anything, but I'm certainly an open to suggestions in that regard. I did want to go back real quickly to an agency update. Park has updated its SOPs, and I'll be providing you a copy of that. They are extremely minor this time around. So I'm not expecting a lot of feedback in that regard, but you want to get to your data?
Sure. Well, I guess I'll let Crystal, if you want to talk through this a little bit. And, you know, if you want to talk about the tables we selected and then get a little bit of feedback, and it might be that not all of these tables make the final cut, but this is a starting point. We're just hoping to get your feedback on that. So, Crystal, why don't you take it away?
Excuse me. Is the purpose of this kind of the certainty severity indices that OHA is kind of committed to providing to PARC for the LEDGE report?
Exactly, yes. It's been a while since we've been able to contribute to the LEDGE report, and now with our new data system, we're in a position to do that. And as I mentioned before, Crystal was able to produce this information in very short order, very impressive. So, you know, there's some caveats in here, so I'll just let Crystal talk through this a little bit.
Thanks, Curtis. So, this starts off with an analysis of the certainty. That's because the case is to be considered a confirmed case. It needs to have we need to know if the health effects are related, if they're reasonably associated with that clinical. So the first thing is the certainty. We look at definite, probable, and possible as being confirmed cases. And then all these other designations, suspicious, insufficient information, that kind of thing, are not considered confirmed. And this goes by the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health criteria. An important caveat, if you look at the 2017 numbers, we generally didn't enter the lowest three classifications because that was a data backlog. So if the case was already determined essentially not to be a case, those just didn't get entered. So we don't know how many of those we have. And then another note, with insufficient information, that might mean that the person didn't know what the chemical was, or maybe we couldn't find enough information about what the health effects should be, that kind of thing. So that kind of underscores the importance of getting the chemical information for us, because if we don't have the chemical, then we can't know if it's a case or not. So once we determine what's actually a case, meaning we reasonably tied the health effects to that exposure, then we assess everything from that standpoint. So all the tables after the first table are just confirmed cases. So so if you look at 2016 and 2017, there's mostly low severity cases, just a few moderate severity cases, but pretty typical. It has to be pretty severe to get a higher moderate severity indication. Does anyone have any questions so far?
Can you hit the mute button, please? Yes, thanks, Crystal. I think you mentioned something at the last PARC meeting about your initial findings with Essence data, our syndromic surveillance, that you'll find in future reports. It'll probably be a couple of biennial reports from now, but you'll see the high numbers come up. And Crystal, you want to just remind folks about that?
Yeah, so very interesting preliminary data from our Essence cases. We're finding there's actually been a few fatalities and a few highs, a lot more moderate cases found with the Essence surveillance, which pretty interesting, especially considering almost none of those cases overlapped with known cases. So these are cases we didn't know about at all before, have no way of finding except through this method, and they're more severe, which kind of makes sense because it is emergency room and urgent care data. They're also more certain, so there's a lot more definite because the symptoms are particularly well they're very well documented in the medical records, so that makes it it's more certain, and then it also makes it more likely to be severe. So yeah, that would be interesting when that shows up in the data.
Hey, Crystal. Crystal, this is Ted. When people use pesticides to commit suicide, how do you all receive that information? Or how would you?
So that can come over, we receive those information from a Poison Center report, and we have received a few of those in the Essence cases as well. We actually had a really bad one in 2019. I mean, I guess those would all be bad, but we did have a fatality that was pretty disturbing. That came in just recently.
I usually find about them through ORS reports.
Yeah, that's interesting. When we get ORS reports too, of course. This one wasn't in ORS that I was thinking of. So that'll be interesting. I mean, they're coming in more than one way.
Understood, thanks.
Yeah, Sharice. Sure.
Do you find that our information, because we supply our data to Essence, do you find that you're getting more information from Essence, from the Poison Center, than what we send you?
Oh, well, so it's true, Essence is hooked up to the Poison Center data, but we're not actually doing we aren't even streaming the Poison Center data stream right now. We're hoping to add that. I think we've mentioned hooking that in, but we would need to get that field hooked up where it says, I think you have a field that says sent to OHA or something like that.
Yeah.
And so we would have to query it and get that hooked up. So that's something we'd like to do at some point, but we aren't even doing that right now. The other thing that can happen is if the provider for some reason doesn't call Poison Center, then it wouldn't end up being sent.
Right. So maybe you and I should talk and try to figure things out so we do not double our efforts in getting information. Because if you're already getting it, then we just figure out, we could talk.
Yeah, because because the reports I get from Poison Center are also identified, and the Essence data is de-identified. And so we could get it from Essence Poison Center, but it might be done differently. There's multiple ways we could do it, so let's definitely follow up. But that's a good point, because that would make it more efficient, too.
Okay. We'll do that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So the next tables, I ran this kind of because we can, but it's also really interesting. This is specific chemicals. This was actually the hardest part this was the most difficult data to obtain because this is the chemicals that cause the most health effects. So, for example, this sulfur metron, I'm probably saying that wrong, but it's an herbicide, and we had 16 confirmed cases in 2016. That's actually a really difficult number to obtain because there might have been one event with 16 cases that had this chemical, or there might have been three cases that all had that chemical included within it. And so this number is a little tricky. So this represents 16 times that was included in whatever the person was exposed to. So because one person might be exposed to 5 chemicals at a time. So I found that interesting. And then, so these are just ranked by frequency. And then, 2017 is pretty different. So I'm interested to run this over a longer time frame and get an idea of, kind of patterns. You can see there's a few, glyphosate shows up, I think 2,4-D's in both of them, and there's quite a few pyrethrins. We do get a lot of pyrethrin cases, like a raid fogger shows off. That's pretty common, that kind of thing. So now we can look at this and see kind of what the burden of every specific chemical is. So that's interesting. Any questions about this part?
Yes.
Cool.
Generally speaking, when I look at the top three, do you have any idea in terms of the site of application?
I can find out, but I could almost find out like live, but not quite. There'd be like a 2-minute delay.
The reason that I'm asking is because you have a couple of state agencies at the table who would also be interested in knowing. These are common herbicides, and I see some eyebrows go up, and so I'm going to ask on their behalf that we generally find out about the site of application. To my knowledge, at least from a human case, that allegations of adverse health effects are reported. I don't believe we have any during this time period that are ODOT specific. I think the ones that might be forestry specific are also low. I did a public records request recently, specific for forestry data. And at least in terms of the number of forestry-related park incidents we had during that biennium, it was like 10 out of 175. So just curious about those three herbicides. I'm also a little surprised I'm also a little surprised that you don't have any fungicides on your list. This list or the next one. That's all.
Right. And there is a longer list. But it starts running into like one instance of this or three instances of that, and so I just cut it off. But I tried to do the top 10, but the numbers didn't cooperate because I had like a bunch that had five, for example.
Sure, understood.
So that was rather annoying. but yeah, I am interested in writing more numbers. It's tricky. So I can query our database for a particular EPA TC code, so I can see like how many bifenthrin cases there were in a given time frame. But then I have to look at those particular cases and see. So I could call out, for example, like the top three by event site, for example, and see what the breakdown was. It might get unwieldy if I did it for all of them because they're all going to have, I'm assuming, more than one type of event site. What do you think, Ted? Would that be a good way to do it?
Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it later.
Should be interesting, though.
Yes.
All right.
Let me make a quick note.
Data we haven't been able to look at before. And then the next one is the month of onset. I think the July numbers, I need to add a little asterisk or something there, but I think it might be a little bit misleading because this covers report date of July 1st to June 30th. And so if it's reported July 1st, I think it might miss some that happened in June, but weren't reported yet. So I think that might change the numbers slightly. So some of the June cases probably actually happened in July, but were reported in June, that kind of thing. But generally we see the seasonality that we expect. There's a big bump in September 2016. That might be Coos Bay Children's Academy.
Yes. Yep.
Right. And that also changes the number of pyrethrin cases for 2016. So that's probably why we're seeing a higher frequency of some of those. Let's see. And then the frequencies for 2017 also might be higher. because some of these were entered after the beginning. And our new system for entering chemicals is that we can put in the EPA number, and then it queries Washington State database called Pickle Pesticide Information Center Online, I think it is.
That's correct.
And then it automatically fills in the chemical ID and the associated chemical name and the method of action. And so what that's going to do is it's going to improve how many chemicals are listed, because if you're hand entering an EPA number, in the past, I think it would be very easy to not, for someone to have missed some of the associated chemicals. And so, or they might have put in the EPA number, but not the chemical, or they might have missed some of those. And so I think we'll see more chemicals over time just because that data entry is so much easier and more streamlined. And then age.
Excuse me, Crystal?
We generally see. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
What happened in May of 17?
I don't know. Maybe that was
Coos Bay.
Maybe Coos Bay was. Wasn't that in the spring? Maybe that was Coos Bay.
I think that's what it was.
So I don't know what happened September 16th. That was some other problem.
Yeah, that's Curry County.
The second one. That was Curry County 2. And there was only 3 people in that one, to my knowledge.
What about the first one?
The first one was like 13, October 13. No, yep. I'm pretty sure. I'd have to go back. Yeah.
And those are also report dates, so that makes it a little bit tricky, because if I try and find it, it might... Well, do you want me to look? I can actually look. That's September 2016. Now you guys have me curious. That's report date.
While she's doing that, Ted, was your question at all related to what you and Garnett were talking about there as far as the correlation between not having the worker protection standards and number of cases, or?
I don't think so.
No, okay.
Not for forestry, but for like the child care center and the hospitals, hotels, things like that. The mill.
May 2017 is Coos Bay.
Yep.
And
I figured that. Because then on the last one, if you look at the by county, 31 for Coos in 2017, that had to have been Coos Bay Children's Academy. Had to have been.
Yeah.
Well, that query is running as we speak, and so I guess we'll come back to that after it's done thinking. The next part's age. So generally we have older adults, and then again there is that that spike in 0-4 in 2017. Yeah. So yeah, that has to be Coos Bay. Because that was small children generally. But without that anomaly, we usually have more older adults, typically. A lot of the health reports come in are, they might be occupational, but a lot of them are people doing bug bombs that basically don't get out in time. It's pretty common. Okay, here's my, my data just came up. So we're looking at 2016 report September, is that right?
Correct.
So my data sorts by onset, but I bet this, it looks like a lot of, okay. They don't look related.
Good on one hand. Just a high number. That's all. It's just a high number. That's all for September of 16. That's all.
Yeah, so just an oddity. I might check those again, though, just to make sure. So we generally have more females than males reporting health effects. I don't know why. Does anyone else have a theory?
I think, yeah. I think
same thing with Park. Same thing with Park. And Jeff is saying NPIC is the same. Probably just more likely to report for whatever reason.
Yeah. If I spray myself in the eye, I'll call it the idiot tax, so I'm not going to tell anyone about it.
It goes along with asking for directions.
Yeah. Oh, you're on thin ice now.
Right. But who knows what's going on there. And then our latest ethnicity data, I do think is a lot better in real time, but left something to be desired in 2016 and 17.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make this part of the discussion quick. Basically, we don't have a lot of data there, which is. But I think the newer data will be a lot more informed. And then I went ahead and included it by county for both years. There is that little spike in Coos County again. There's a decent number in Lane County for 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Multnomah a lot in 2017. So there's just a lot of variation, and a lot of those probably depend on a couple of problems. And then if our surveillance isn't very good, then we might miss some of that background. Numbers. So, anyway, that's what we have so far. Any questions that came out as part of that?
Just comment on the last, the county. You're certainly going to find, as Park has found over the past years, that the more people, the more incidents.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
Yeah, that's true. I almost want to run this per 100,000, but it's just such small numbers. But I'm hoping if we do a larger report, we might aggregate it over more time, and then maybe we can run it by population.
Yeah, it's not going to change.
Because if there's just like one or two cases, it's almost not worth running those numbers yet.
But it does help to pull out, again, you know, the counties that do stand out, or mm-hmm. when you compare one year to the other, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Like Marion County had an okay number both years, but more in 2016, which is interesting. Like, or Multnomah, of course, we're going to see a little bit in some of those bigger counties every time, but still varies a lot.
Yeah.
I'm trying to recall if Park
anyway,
has ever seen one in Morrow.
Feel free to send more questions or suggestions as anyone thinks of them. And thank you.
Thanks, Crystal. Well, we've reached the end of the agenda, and it's not quite 11:30, so that's not a bad thing. So I guess we'll, between now and the next park, you might see a request for some feedback from Ted, perhaps, on the 15-17, if we package things, or maybe you'll be asking for maybe if you want to give us some guidance on what you want to see for notable events, if you want any of that included.
Yeah, so I think I've already made a request for notable events. If agencies want to submit notable events, you certainly could look at the 13-15 legislative report for an example of notable events. Let's see here.
You probably take something out of it. Take the summary of the Coos Bay.
So Curry County was mentioned in the 13-15 Ledge report as a notable event, but forestry had an accomplishment, because we also have an agency accomplishments page. That's when forestry first mentioned ferns coming online. What else? Oh, we talked about forestry. And ODA supplying to OHA information to conduct public health investigation Triangle Lake, because we had to develop an SOP after that data request, and that's out there. We talked about parks SOPs because they weren't out there prior. We also said there's a bullet point, or Oregon Department of Agriculture hires the first full-time park coordinator in April of 13. That was me. We did have something about lessons learned from Curry County. So during the 2015 session, you guys, most of y'all probably know that Curry County, the incident that happened in Curry County, you weren't here. So on a Friday, I'm pretty sure it was October of 13, Park's phone started ringing. And by the end of the day, I think probably 10 people had called. That continued Monday morning. Pest also started receiving phone calls. Prior to Crystal, Justin Waltz was the pest coordinator. And I think by the end of the week, between the two of us, there was probably 40 individuals that had contacted either park or pest, reporting adverse health effects that they associated with an aerial application in forestry. Long story short, two forestry units. The person that was doing the application, instead of flying around the residence, basically flew over. Ultimately, the Department of Ag sampled, found product, and issued notices of violations and civil penalties. And so that's Curry County. There was actually what I'm going to call a Curry County 2 that only involved three individuals, similar situation. Curry County was a pretty...
More like 50, it was 15.
I meant 15, excuse me.
Even prosecuted the...
No, it was 13. I remember. I distinctly remember, because I hadn't been here 7 months. And my phone starts ringing, and it's like, what?
It was a terrible park meeting when they all drove to Salem to testify. Yeah. It wasn't as bad as the one in Portland, though.
Understood, but there was definitely some contention around that time. One of the lessons that certainly ODA learned, a couple of things. At that time, believe it or not, when ODA was conducting an investigation, we believed that the details in that investigation we could not release. We've since learned that it's pretty much a public process all along the way. So any information we gain during the investigation, if people request it, then we can provide that information. Another lesson learned.
So there was a state legislator that was involved.
Yes. Yes. Came to park board meeting, I believe.
Community meeting in the high school gymnasium in Gold Beach, which I participated in. it was an interesting situation because the state agency folks down along the coast were very leery about participating. You can imagine. They're not from Portland. They're not engaged in the park. This was something that was deemed risky to participate.
Well, and at the time, the state elected officials of Curry County were really anti-agency, anti-government. Yes. Held off on a lot of different kinds of enforcement too, because our budget would be cut in the legislature if we acted on violations.
Yeah. And so there's all of those underlying. All of those underlying concerns. So Lisa told me that once the local agency folks, learned that I was going to participate, they all decided to participate. And so it turned out to be a better event than it might have been, you know, otherwise. This is all coming back to me now. But I drove down. I first went to. Medford and met with who was the local inspector down there at the time.
OSHA or
ODA.
Was it Jessica?
Yeah.
That's right.
So I went and met with Jessica.
Excuse me, Jessica used to be park coordinator halftime.
Yeah.
Then she became an investigator, moved down south.
Mm-hmm. So I went and met with Jessica, I think the day before, and went over, you know, because she was the on-the-ground person, right?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, she was in the middle of it from the beginning.
She didn't go to the meeting, did she?
No.
Okay.
No, she did not go to the meeting. But I kind of debriefed with Jessica. Then I actually drove to the site. It's an inner valley off the coast. It kind of runs parallel to the coast for about 10 or so miles. You can get on to from Little Beach. You kind of parallel the coast, but an inner valley, and then the road comes back to the coast of Iowa again. Very narrow, following a creek. Homes, and so you can see how if something inadvertently spilled on that site where it would have. I was physically there and saw how it probably happened. It was a very interesting town hall meeting that they Lisa brought in a moderator, professional. What do they call those folks that moderate meetings? There's another name.
Facilitator.
Yes. Yeah. Lisa brought in a professional facilitator that set all the ground rules for the meeting, kept people from veering outside of the sidebars. I didn't have any problem with it because I'm not that kind of person.
You know, I'm going to say generally, park member agencies have learned a lot. From these types of incidents.
Yes, and Tribal Lake was another one.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot more.
Oh, yeah.
And Mike Oldenfall was there, I think. Mike. And so he brought back that experience.
If having been through Triangle Lake, perfect experience, unfortunately, for dealing with Curry County. Understood. Yeah.
Triangle Lake was the one where they had the state police and other officers lining the road on the way to the meeting, and just in case, you know, if there was an altercation.
Real quickly, I was at the last Triangle Lake meeting, public meeting. Got down there, and there was probably about 100 individuals. And so state agency reps are huddled up, getting our game plan together. When two guys dressed in white Tyvek suits carrying about 2 gallon sprayers that they had put food coloring in, walking around pretending they're spraying. Helicopter flies overhead, and you can tell that he has covered up the tail number to the helicopter. And the sheriff gets in his car and leaves. And I said, Mike, we need to follow him. Because on the way, I'm looking at my phone and my bars are disappearing. I said, Mike, I don't have any bars. I don't have any bars. I'm not comfortable around with no bars. I'm just not comfortable with no bars. Anyway.
I can tell you the people that live in the Coast Ridge are real comfortable with no bars.
Probably 5 minutes later, the sheriff comes back and he has 4 state troopers with him. I felt a lot better. That's my Triangle Lake story.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing, everybody. And our next meeting is going to be at the Office of the State Fire Marshal. We've met there before.
Correct. South Tentatively.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
I'll just bring one more thing up that's kind of related. You know, we've got a new dean at OSU, an agriculture science. And he's going around to all the departments, to the department heads, asking the department heads for stories about how the departments have done something that's of value to society outside of the agency. this is a real effective way to communicate what the college does to folks outside of the university. So I'm just throwing that out there as maybe something that could be included in a future park report. Kind of explore the idea of how, you know, a paragraph here and there about how park responded, or park member agencies as a result of being a part of this organization have responded in a positive way.
CDC and NIOSH do the same thing.
Yeah,
they have the stories, and it's like that catches your attention.
And just because we consider it tell these stories, you can see that they could have impact.
Oh, yeah. Good thought.
And we have a story as in, I've yet lived, but regarding the virus.
Which is the reason I said tentatively at the state fire marshal. Who knows what the next 2 months is going to bring from a human coronavirus perspective.
True. Just keep that in mind. It could be a completely virtual park meeting. There's no reason we couldn't do that.
Right.
It's only a few hours.
Yep.
It's not too bad. So, yeah, just keep that in mind.
The 18th, I have a Seattle EPA director's meeting.
You tell me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll see everybody next week at the Pesticide Symposium, hopefully.
All right.
Is there an updated agenda for that?
I can send it to you. Yeah, I'm going to send another update to remind everybody.
If you can make it, I highly suggest it.
Off the wall request that we got about the tree down.
Thanks for helping.
Yeah, yeah, it's not like bringing that
green.